Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Look, I have to remind you that you can subscribe to this on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, and it wouldn't do any harm, really, to leave us a five-star review with your candid and honest assessment, although I'd appreciate the five-star review. Joined by one of our old friends today who has an absolutely outstanding book, Tim Carney, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. And I know for a fact, Tim, that you were working on this this concept years ago, even before the election of Donald Trump, because you and I discussed this over a beer in Milwaukee. Do you remember this?
It was a lakefront brewery I had two different orders of fried cheese curds. And you did help me formulate this, right, in between my trips to Oostburg, which features prominently in the book.
And I want to talk about Oostburg, because that actually is one of the extraordinary communities. And so I think I tweeted out at one point, that's one of my favorite towns to take the bike trail to. You can actually take the bike trail north from where I live through Port Washington, Wisconsin, all the way up to Oostburg, which is kind of a different place in the world. And I think you were really ahead of the curve on that. But of course, we have to have a conversation that we should have had a couple of days ago, right? Because of the miracle of modern flight and communications, you emailed me, and I was on an airplane. And it was one of those airplanes where they say, "Hey, we're really, really sorry. The Wi-Fi that we promised is not there." And you go, "Well, you know, really?" I was just about to cite Louis C.K., but that really seems inappropriate. You know that routine I'm talking about?
I know exactly what. Okay. Yes, the world's great and everybody's unhappy.
That's right. You didn't even know you had it 5 minutes ago, and now you're upset by it. And I don't want to be that guy. But you had some questions. You have a piece up at the Washington Examiner, "The Holy War Over Trump," and you wanted to talk to me about this before you wrote the piece. Things that I'm quoted as saying in the Bulwark about our next target, that we have a holy war against certain other conservatives, and you point out that a fatwa against political scientist Henry Olson reflects odd priorities, which it would indeed if there was a fatwa. Now, that's not my word, is it, right? I never use the word fatwa, right?
No, I use the word fatwa. Okay. Yes.
So, because we don't use that in Wisconsin. That's not a... No, nobody in Oostburg declares a fatwa against anyone. So, I would have assured you, no, we have no fatwa. We're just doing what I think opinion journalists always do, which is to hold people accountable and not just the low-hanging fruit. I mean, it's easy to hold the, you know,
Candace Owens.
We can do the Charlie Kirk, the Candace Owens, the Tommy Lahrens. You know, and I was asked a question and I answered it. And I said, well, there's also people who are much more substantive. And we I think it's also important to challenge them as we have, including, you know, for example, and I like Henry Olson. I've been at a lot of events with him. But when he wrote a piece in the Washington Post ripping Mitt Romney for raising questions about Donald Trump's character, I thought that needed a response, and I wrote that response. And then other folks, including him and Mark Tyson, were very eloquent, very forceful advocates for the shutdown, the government shutdown over the wall that turned out to be a fiasco. And we wrote a piece about that as well. So the impression that somehow I was threatening a fatwa, no. But I also think that we can have a vigorous debate. So tell me what your concern was. I know you and I know your work, and I think you know me and you know my work.
Yeah.
What you were concerned about that would have gone beyond a healthy debate?
Beyond a healthy debate. So again, it matters on whether how accurately The Atlantic presented what you're up to. But I think that we need to not draw the bounds of sort of permissible behavior, permissible attitudes towards Trump too narrowly. In other words, obviously we have these lines, right? Mm-hmm. We have, you know, you're not going to defend slavery and be acceptable. You're not going to defend Mao and be acceptable. But to go ahead and say, well, we're going that Trump is better than Hillary and that we're glad that we have him, or even things that I would disagree with. And I'm not convinced of that. Mm-hmm. But to things that I would disagree with, people saying Trump is better and more conservative in practice than Bush. I know people who make valid arguments like that fall short. And so when the word grifters is used, there's lots of people I call grifters, right, and you call grifters. But for people like Henry Olson, Mark Thiessen, Byron York, these words don't apply. These are people who have a very different approach to both some of the policies that Trump does, but also how we're going to handle the extraordinary thing that is a Trump presidency.
Okay, no, that is fair enough. And, you know, if we'd been able to talk before your piece, I would have certainly clarified there. There are trolls and grifters. And, of course, we see a lot of those at CPAC, and we know who these low-hanging fruit would be. But, you know, I was asked a question, and I answered it, which is also that it's not just, you know, I do think that we need to have a debate with the people who are the much more serious thought leaders without questioning their motivation. And I think that's where I wanted to clarify with you. You know, I'm not suggesting that these folks, but there are areas of disagreement. So, for example, when someone writes a column defending the president's character and then attacking Mitt Romney for raising the issue, I think that needs to be addressed. When you have folks who are significant thought leaders who cheerlead for a self-defeating shutdown over the wall, I think that's legitimate to say, let's debate that particular issue. We're going to call you out on that particular issue.
Yeah.
And I do take your point that, you know, if in fact there was a jihad or a fatwa, which was not my word at all, that would be inappropriate. But to say that we have a vigorous debate, I'm not sure that we're doing anything different. And as I think when we were talking about this before, what I was trying to do is describe what we've already done, not prescribe. The pieces that we've actually run in on the publication are pretty much what we intend to do. But I do think that there ought to be, you know, that there ought to be certain lines, as you point out. So, for example, if you have a very prominent conservative thought leader who tweets support for the, you know, neo-Nazi candidate for the mayor of Toronto, that needs to be highlighted. And you and I think, understand that our failure to do this over the years has had real consequences.
No, and I also think that in general, I think Trump will have real negative consequences on us.
Right.
But one of the things that I am sensitive about, and what I wrote in my column on this, is I remember the Iraq War when most of the Iraq War supporters, I was not one, most of the people I disagreed with on the Iraq War were happy to debate. But there was definitely a number, and some of them were important and powerful, who said, no, if you're on the other side, that's a line too far. That means you're unpatriotic. That means that and we're not going to debate you because we're not going to normalize you. We're not going to legitimize you because you're across the line. And that really left an impression on me of this is the wrong way to do it. This is how we upright are going to lose if we're not able to have these debates without positing that everybody on the other side it has some sort of cynical motive.
No, and I just want to repeat, I was actually, and I probably should have done it with more precision to distinguish between, yes, we're going to go after the low-hanging fruit, the Seb Gorkas, you know, the Candace Owens, all those folks. But I also think it's important to engage the more serious people. But these are not the grifters and the trolls. They are merely wrong on things. And I do think that's what opinion journalism is all about, to call them out when they are wrong, as you did me. Your piece calls me out.
Yes.
So I don't think we are doing anything different for them than what you at the Washington Examiner are willing to do to some of us over here at the Bowl.
I'm glad that. So I may have been arguing with the Atlantic's portrayal of the Bulwark rather than with the Bulwark.
Well, okay. Let's move on, because I really did want to talk about. And by the way, you did. I don't know whether you did this intentionally, but I thought it was brilliant. If you did it by accident, it's even more brilliant in many ways. So I'm actually at the Green Room at NBC, and you had left behind, or somebody had left behind, a copy of your book. And while I'm waiting to go on, I'm picking it up and going, why have I not talked to Tim Carney? Why have we not done anything about this book? This is a really, really important book. So my advice to all authors is just casually. Did you do that on purpose?
Yeah, I did that.
Oh, that was really, really good. So am I giving away a secret now?
No, that's fine.
All authors should leave behind copies of their books in the green rooms for these sorts of things. So let's go back to when I bought you a beer, or more likely you bought me a beer Do you remember? I have no idea. I don't remember. I just remember the beer was really, really good that day in Milwaukee. And we were talking about Oostburg, Wisconsin, which is a Reformed Dutch community. And it's right next to Cedar Grove, which is very, very much like Oostburg. And you were telling me the story of how of your reporting on Oostburg and why at the time, I think it was in the context that Oostburg was going to be like a 70% anti-Trump community, you know, despite being ex-urban. So this is sort of pick up on what you learned from Oostburg, Wisconsin.
So Oostburg is, as you said, half of the population says they're Dutch. Another 40% calls themselves German. And almost all of them go to church, a majority of them twice on Sundays, because that's the Reformed thing to do, is you've got the 9:15 a.m. and then the 6 p.m. And so it was this eye-opening experience to me. It had been called by one Wisconsin blog the most conservative town in Wisconsin. And that in the end, I'm still friends, email friends with the town clerk there, the village clerk. When she emailed me the results, sure enough, Trump got 15% in Oostburg while getting about 33% statewide.
This is the Wisconsin primary.
In the primaries again, and Cruz dominates there. So Cruz barely wins the state, but he beats Trump 5-1 in Oostburg. And I had anticipated this because the Dutch county in Iowa was Trump's worst county in the caucuses. He got only 10% in Sioux County. Mm-hmm. And Western Michigan, where Holland and Grand Rapids and Moline and all these other very Dutch places are, was by far Trump's worst part in the Michigan primaries. And so I sort of wanted to figure out what was making these places tick. Were they pissed off that Trump was appropriating the color orange? I didn't know. And then I'm sitting there on Sunday, and it's so obvious as they come pouring in from Bethel Orthodox Church, from the First Christian Reformed Church, from the First Reformed Church, from the Presbyterian Church, that the town is just robustly involved and connected. There's high social trust because it's built around these churches and the institutions that spin out of them. And this was sort of the final sort of Rosetta Stone for me. Trump's appeal in those primaries was to people who believed the American dream was dead. And the American dream was alive not only in the elite places, you know, the Wisconsin examples would be, you know, Waukesha County and Maryland, I use Chevy Chase, but also in these really strong religious places like Oostburg, like Salt Lake City, where the American dream was alive, there wasn't that need for this strong man proclaiming the American dream was dead.
Okay, so the book is Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. Oostburg, Cedar Grove, they thrive. What's the code?
So the code is strong institutions of civil society, little platoons is really, and so the economic explanation that gets given out, the factory shut down, the immigrants took our job, or the sort of the sneering explanation of these deplorables won't get on with their lives and can't accept the change that women's rights and blacks have. Both of those have elements of truth, but they fall short. When the factory shuts down, sometimes it's the first domino that then knocks down the crucial institutions, which is not just the one big employer, but is the coffee shop, the bowling league, and most importantly, the church. So the suffering of the working class in America today is a plague of alienation that leaves them disconnected, which is without a safe, small safety net, without a sense of purpose, without the modeling and connection that little platoons provide.
You know, I was at a forum earlier this week where there were, you know, some foundations and think tanks, and they were talking about, you know, how do you bridge the divide? You know, how do we get Americans talking with one another? And there was this very, very elaborate presentation of the use of technologies and the way in which, you know, a lot of jargon, actually.
Yes.
And at the end of it, I said to the guy, I says, so what you're basically saying is that we need to reconstitute bowling teams. There was a little bit of a pause, and he said, yeah, that's pretty much it. It's not rocket science, but it's incredibly complicated. How do you knit together, you know, all of those institutions that have been torn apart? I mean, those institutions, that civil society took centuries to build.
Organically and without any central planner. Saying,
exactly.
We need a fourth church in Oostburg, and over there in Moline, Michigan, we need to have a softball league. It was organically developed to serve the needs of the people. It took years. And so I think we almost have natural experiments right now. One that I write about in Alienated America is Williston, North Dakota. The front of the cover of the book is a shuttered church mm-hmm. right outside of Williston. And of course, this is fracking country, right? And there's a natural experiment that happened there that I write about, which is all the blue collar guys all started making a ton of money. And one of the problems I write about is the how the working class is retreating from marriage. Marriage has dropped off among everybody, but it's just cratered among people who don't have college educations. And there's an explanation on the left, oh, this is just because they don't have enough money to start a family. Well, fracking means all the blue-collar guys in a lot of these towns, they suddenly have a lot of money. So you wait a couple of years and see if marriage returns. A study by a liberal economist said, no, actually, I thought it would, but it absolutely didn't. There was an uptick in out-of-wedlock births, but there was not an uptick in marriage. And so my thought is, so that's a study from 2016 about a fracking boom that started in 2006. What if we revisit in 2026? Right now, I can already see in Williston, the little leagues are growing. The public schools are trying to catch up to the growing size. So it could just be that if there's not an external blockage, detriment to civil society growing, that putting in some money and waiting 20 years will do the trick. The problem is it's really hard to just put in the money if the civil society is not there, because you don't have strong education. You don't have people attached to the place. And so a company's not going to want to set up in Uniontown, PA, because they don't think there's not the infrastructure here of a community. So it's this horrible chicken and egg problem.
Okay, well, let's just drill down on one thing. So why are people not getting married, particularly with blue-collar Americans? What happened to the marriage? Is there an economic explanation, or are there other factors?
I think it's a part economic explanation. But first, to sort of set the picture, too many conservatives think that the retreat from marriage is what I call the Lena Dunham effect. They think it's the women who graduate from Wesleyan with their women's studies degrees swearing off marriage, and that this accounts for why so many fewer people are getting married in America today. But that's really college-educated women are getting married a little bit later. So that counts for a tiny downtick in the marriages. It's about college, about women and men who did not go to college, not getting married, or getting divorced at much higher rates. So it's easy to see that it's just economic. But again, pointing to a place like Williston, I argue, and not to quote Hillary Clinton affirmatively, but to quote her positively, yes, it takes a village. That if you've raised kids, if you've been married, you know that community bonds, which might have otherwise just been nice, become absolutely necessary. And so the erosion of civil society, the bowling alone phenomenon, is at the heart of the retreat from marriage, because fewer places are what you would call a great place to raise a kid. Oostburg is still a great place to raise a kid.
It is.
Wauwatosa is still a great place to raise a kid. But so much of the rural America or the Middletown, Ohio, is where J.D. Vance is from, are not great places because they don't have the little leagues, the church groups, the strong public schools. If you try to get involved, you might be the only involved parent in the elementary school.
You know, it is interesting. You mentioned Hillbilly Elegy, and of course, Charles Murray wrote about this. Coming apart. Ben Sasse has been writing about the epidemic of loneliness. Any thoughts about why it took us so long to realize this was happening?
I think
this is a tectonic shift, isn't it? I mean, over a long period of time.
I really do, and I think J.D. Vance wouldn't have been a bestseller if it weren't for Trump. That we just sort of. It was so political analysis, what you and I were doing. We looked in 2008 and 2012, and we talked about the evangelical vote. So you had Romney picking up the establishment Republicans, and then either Huckabee or Santorum picking up the evangelical vote. But there we were blurring together two different votes. We were blurring together Sioux County, Iowa, where everybody goes to church twice on Sundays, with the other county I use in Alienated America, the alienated county, is Fremont, Iowa, where the churches are all closing down. And so the Cruz-Trump divide, for me, that's how I saw it. It showed up on the map of the rural Iowa being split in two among the strong communities with the church going and the crumbling communities with the churches closing.
Functional versus dysfunctional.
So yeah.
The hard part, of course, is how to put this back together again. I mean, I don't think you have any illusions about that at all. But
I'm going to go back. Federal bill, Charlie, with enough creation. No, obviously not.
Create a federal department. to do all this. So, you know, and when, you know, and Ben Sasse points out, you know, that, you know, we're lonely. We have an epidemic of loneliness, which I think is true, and that we that all of these civil ties have frayed. And anywhere you go, you see people living in a virtual artificial world of social media, as opposed to interacting with real people. Neighbors don't know one another. People have conversations and relationships without actually ever meeting one another eye to eye. Probably the most common, okay, this is like not safe for work, what I'm about to say. Probably the most common sex act in America is involves pornography.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reverse all of that, since all of these technological and cultural trends seem to be atomizing us further rather than re-knitting these social bonds?
Well, so the first thing to realize is, again, an error that conservatives make, even though it's a liberal fatal conceit error, is to look at something like the retreat from marriage and say, well, we need some government program to promote marriage, and to ignore that it takes an organic community to do it.
Oh, but that sounds hard.
That's
come on. Let me just say, if we just had another tax program,
yeah.
And by the way, I'm sympathetic to that, but I, you know,
and the child tax credit, man, I am the biggest beneficiary of that, but I don't know that it's
I think you get about half the total allotment, right?
Yeah, the national debt should have my picture next to it because of the child tax credit expansion.
Tim Carney, father of his nation, father of the nation,
father of the debt. Yeah. But no, so I think there was some conservative who was said maybe we just need to ban children from having social media accounts. Again, that's a fatal conceit. But you know what? The schools where I send my kids, they basically ban it. And that's part of the reason we love this is because we as parents couldn't pull it off.
Yeah,
I know so many parents who want to, but they can't pull it off. But we immerse ourselves in a community that makes that the norm. And it's an unsatisfying answer, especially for those of us in Washington, to say it's going to take 20,000 little platoons doing this. But you know what? We're not. It's not just us crazy conservative Catholics. In Palo Alto, there the parents are all saying, oh, no, our kids are not getting on these social media accounts. So the same parents who are writing the code are banning it. And so the elites and the strong religious communities are building these norms that protect community. And so the reason I think there's some hope is because, again, you can replicate what's going on either in the strong small town in New England built around the public school with local control, or what's going on in Oostburg. You can't replicate what's going on in Chevy Chase, but you can replicate the small communities.
So if you put these things in ideological terms, people might push back against them, but in terms of actual experience and what families are seeing and raising children, they get it and they're responding to it.
That's exactly right. And you or I talk about the importance of marriage and family and that sort of thing, or I talk about my Catholic social teaching, it gets chastised. But if you look at what they're actually doing in the Chevy Chases, the elite liberal communities,
they're doing it.
Life that we're preaching.
Yeah, this the same people who would roll their eyes if you talked about the importance of marriage and all of these things. You know, you do mention how unsatisfying some of this is, but you know, this is one of the things that I do think that conservatives understood years ago, which is that social science and politics does not necessarily have a solution for every social problem. I mean, that is the conceit, I think, of both of social science and of progressives, that if there's a problem, there must be a solution, and that solution must be a government solution, as opposed to recognizing that some of the government solutions that you might imagine actually end up undermining those institutions. You know, for example, you just mentioned how you're glad that the school banned social media because you wouldn't be able to do it on your own. Well, there used to be a time when society as a whole backed up parents and the parents could and families could be quite confident that the general society, the institutions and the culture of society would support their efforts. And that has not been true for a very, very, very long time.
No. And it's absolutely true. And you talk to some of the other elite private schools around here, and the teachers feel like they're working against the parents. We picked a school where the teachers said, we are in a conspiracy with you against your kids. And that used to be the norm. And it wasn't just individual parents. It was the institutions around that were providing that support, not just sort of preaching and showing the same morality, but in fact, even correcting the missteps, because kids are always going to misstep.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because, as you know, I wrote a few books about dumbing down our kids in the education system. And you know, as I talk to people about it, it really became clear that it was really unfair to blame just the educational system for what was going on, because the number of conversations I had with teachers and administrators and professionals who basically said they were at war with the parents, that it's the reverse of when I was a kid, where it was the, you know, Charlie, if you do that again, we're calling your parents. Oh my God, no, don't do that. Don't go, you know. Now it's like, you know, teacher, if you say that to me again, I'm calling my parents. And they're, you know, and it's like a completely turned on its head. And that's where you get the sense that, you know, it is deeper. It is in the fabric of society, and there's not simply going to be some systemic fix that's there. Okay, so all books like this, and I've written them as well, the shortest chapters tend to be the solutions. But I think you've already touched on it, that this will take generations, and it's going to have to be organic.
Yeah, and that the main thing I say about federal and state governments is they have to stop making it worse. So crowding out is a problem. Right. Welfare spending crowds out charitable organizations and church entities. The left. The attitude towards the church, when Nancy Pelosi says, I do my religion on Sundays to defend these mandates that are trying to basically drive the Little Sisters of the Poor out of business, is saying the church does not belong in the public square. And that's a widely held view, and it's really detrimental, and the government needs to stop behaving that way. But after a few thou shalt nots, I don't have much prescriptions for the federal government. It's up to little platoons to revitalize. And on the right, on the conservative side, it's saying, you know what, take your attention away from Washington for a moment and turn towards your own backyard. And that's really a danger. So when Donald Trump goes ahead and says, we're having a great 4th of July celebration, no, I hope nobody in America stays home and watches Trump's 4th of July fireworks, because everybody should be out there at their local Knights of Columbus or swimming pool fireworks. That's what America is, are these tiny little platoons. And that what we got to do is make sure that we're not confusing patriotism with this centralization of all, not just power, but attention.
Tim Carney, thank you so much. The book is Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. And this is the hopeful thing for me, is that you actually have the model. Say, okay, what does functioning civil society look like? Well, we don't have to invent it. We don't have to make it up. We don't have to go and have a big whiteboard presentation about it. You just go to Oostburg or Cedar Grove or the communities that you describe in the book. So, Tim, thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.